Women and Money with Sarah Pennells. Finance from a female perspective.
Well, this is indeed Women and Money, and my name is Sarah Pennells. And as well as presenting programmes for Share Radio, I'm also the founder of a money website for women called savvywoman.co.uk. And in today's programme, we're going to be looking at benefits and how the recent benefit changes and plan changes could affect families. The start of the new tax year early this month didn't just mean changes to taxes and the introduction of things like the lifetime ISA. It also resulted in some big changes to benefits. Now, critics say that some of these changes will leave families much worse off. And others, such as the introduction of the so-called rape clause, are pretty controversial. But we're going to be talking about how the benefits changes may affect you. And if you have a question, you can tweet me. I'm at @savvy_woman. We're also at Share Radio. We're at Share Radio UK. Well, joining me in the studio is Andrew Baisley, who is from the Fawcett Society. And I'm also joined on the phone by Kelly Jones of the charity Turn to Us. Welcome to the programme. Thank you both very much indeed for joining me. Before we start, I'll ask you first, Andrew, if I may. Can you just tell me a bit about your organisation, the Fawcett Society? I'm sure many people have heard of it, but what exactly does the Fawcett Society do?
Sure. The Fawcett Society is England and Wales's leading women's equality campaign charity. We trace our founding back to 1866 and the first petition to Parliament for votes for women. And in the present day, we campaign alongside our members for women's equality around areas including gender norms and stereotypes, money and power.
And Kelly, same question to you. Just explain what Turn to Us is.
Turn to Us is a UK charity which fights poverty. We do that by making sure that people know what they're entitled to with benefits, to put them in contact with charities which where they may be eligible for grants to help them manage financially. And we also, an arm of our business also gives out grants to help people in financial need.
And Kelly, I'll start with you if I may. There have been, as I said, a number of changes that came in, many of them April the 6th, a few of them a couple of days later. One of the ones was that a range of benefits such as main elements of child tax credit, working tax credit, etc., being frozen. How much of a difference does it make? Because, you know, these days I think a lot of people think, well, inflation is generally fairly low, etc., etc. How much of a difference does it make if benefits like these are frozen?
Well, in the current climate, it does make quite a lot of difference. We know from the Joseph Rowntree report, which was published in February, that about 19 million are below the minimum income standard at the moment for living, and that we can expect cost of living to rise by 10% by 2020. And the current freeze is expected to continue until 2020. So in real terms, people who have their benefits frozen are actually going to be a lot worse off.
And Andrew, one of the other sort of benefit levels that was frozen was it's the childcare element of working tax credit, which is basically where you can get help towards your childcare costs. Now, this, as I understand, it's being frozen at a level of £175 a week for one child, £300 a week for two or more. What's been happening for childcare costs? Because we seem to see a number of reports showing that these costs are actually rising quite sharply.
Sure. So over the past decade, that's certainly true. The last year's Family and Childcare Trust childcare cost survey in 2016 actually found that for the first time since 2008, childcare costs had tracked inflation, which is a welcome reprieve for families with children. But over the last decade, we've seen considerable increases. So childcare costs remain a considerable expense for a lot of families.
Especially obviously if you've got sort of two children or more, then I mean in some cases these costs can be, you know, they can be the size of a small mortgage, can't they, or even a medium-sized mortgage. That it's actually a big chunk of money that can actually put a lot of people off. It is mainly women who do take the time out to look after children still, can put a lot of people off returning to work.
That's certainly true, and it reflects sort of an overall underinvestment in childcare that we've seen over, you know, successive decades from successive governments. And there's a need to put a lot more of money into the childcare system to ensure that more parents, as you say, more women for the most part, are supported into work. For example, there's a lack of 3 and 4 year old childcare places. That's doubled over the last year. So there's a real need to put some considerable effort into this.
And Kelly, one of the other changes that's coming in is this, or that's already come in, is this limit on child tax credit claims for new claims, this two-child limit. Just explain how that works. I think there's quite a lot of confusion about new claims and existing claims and exactly which benefits this affects.
There is a bit of confusion because the two-child limit works differently for different benefits. So if anyone's at all unsure, always get advice. I can briefly outline the changes for you now. For child tax credit, you will only receive the child element for your children that were born before the 6th of April 2017. If you have children after the 6th of April 2017, you'll only get the child element for them if they were born before then. Does that make sense? I think I've made that quite clear. All children born before the 6th of April 2017, you'll still get the child element for.
Yeah, but otherwise not for the third child.
Otherwise, for the third or subsequent child, you won't. There are some exceptions, which I understand you wanted to discuss today. So, they can be briefly described as adoption, kinship care, where you look after someone else's child so that they don't have to go into foster care. Multiple births, so if someone has twins, they won't get the child element for the first one, but they would for the second. And the rape exception, so a child that was conceived as a result of non-consensual conception.
And I mentioned in the introduction that this, what's now been called the rape clause, is quite controversial. Andrew, what's the sort of Fawcett Society's view of this? Because you were saying earlier on, I mean, there are a number of women's charities around domestic violence that have been campaigning about this. So just tell me what actually is going on in this arena, sort of protesting against this.
Sure. So our view is that the rape clause is a disgraceful piece of policy making. The priority for a woman who has experienced rape should be her own mental and physical health. It shouldn't be having to make a decision that involves that experience to ensure that she can put food on the table for her children. And the fact that the government is in a position where it's asking women to do that shows how ill thought through this policy is.
I must confess, because when I was writing about this change, and I had heard about this two-child limit, and I did also know that there was an exemption, basically, you know, if your child is a result of non-consensual sex. But I think it was only when I started actually reading the form and also the consultation, which so the consultation was sort of not really into whether it should go ahead, but sort of how it should go ahead. And particularly when I looked at the form, and I must confess I was absolutely horrified by it and this idea. So just to spell out, because you don't have to go to, you can basically go to sort of somebody who deals, your GP or someone like that, if you want to be able to show, because you've got to sort of have evidence that the baby was a result of non-consensual sex. And the government says there's no time limit in when you can backdate the claims. But to me, I mean, I must confess, I just felt it was so appallingly intrusive. And I cannot imagine if I ever was, you know, if I was in a position where I was raped, I cannot imagine having to get my head round, having to then tell somebody so I could get benefits.
Yeah, it's incredibly callous. I suppose there are three things to say on this. The first one is that women can go to GPs, rape crisis centres, etc. There doesn't seem to have been any provision for additional training for example, GPs to ensure that they're able to sensitively deal with those kind of women approaching them with that issue. The second one is that, you know, some women whose children were conceived as a result of rape may not have already gone to a GP. They may not have already gone to a rape crisis centre. And so to push them to do so for the first time, to make them take that decision based on the need to feed their family rather than their own mental health is just absurd. And then finally, there's the issue around the exemptions to the exemption, as it were, whereby you have to have left the partner who raped you, if it was your partner, or be out of the coercive relationship, if it was a coercive relationship, in order to receive the benefits, which has such a cloth ear to the fact that for the majority of women who are killed by their partner, by an abusive partner, it's the period just after they leave them that's the most dangerous. It's a real error to introduce that element.
And I mean, I must confess, I'm absolutely with you, and I just find this horrifying. But what can people do? Because you said there are a number of charities that are campaigning against this. So if people want to get involved, which charities are kind of spearheading this?
Sure. So Women's Aid, Rape Crisis and Gender Up in Scotland have put a real focus on this. And so I'd definitely advise people to look along, to campaign alongside them. I would say, I mean, also, you know, with the general election coming up, this is a good time to, if you're as outraged about this as we are, to get in touch with your local candidates and ask them what they think about the rape clause and ask them what they would do if they were elected to change it.
Well, you're listening to the Women and Money programme on Share Radio. And in a moment, I'll be finding out about changes to child benefit rates, or in fact, the fact that they are frozen, but also some quite controversial changes to bereavement benefits. Stay listening.
Share Radio. Women and Money. Finance from a female perspective.
This is Share Radio Morning and this is the Women and Money programme. My name's Sarah Pennells and we're talking about changes to benefits. My guests for today's programme are Kelly Jones of the charity Turn to Us, and I'm also joined in the studio by Andrew Baisley of the Fawcett Society. Kelly, I mentioned just a moment ago about child benefit rates, those also being frozen. Just remind us of how much parents can get for their children if they want to claim child benefit.
Yes, well, they have been frozen. The current rates are £20.70 per week for the first child and £13.70 per week for second and subsequent children. The child benefit payable is not limited by the two-child policy, so it's really important that people still claim for their third and more child, even if they are subject to that limit in child tax credit.
I'm really glad you said that, because I saw some of the coverage around the time of April the 6th leading up to it that was talking about, I think they were trying to talk about child benefits in very broad terms, but the sort of headlines were child benefit, you know, two child rule comes in. And as you say, it doesn't affect child benefit, that particular state benefit, but does affect other child-related tax credits. So I'm glad you've clarified that. There are also some changes to universal credit. Now, these came in a few days later. If I mention universal credit and taper relief, most people will probably start crying or, you know, switching off. Explain why this matters and what the change is, Kelly.
Before the change came in April, universal credit was tapered at a rate of 65%. So that meant if you earned a pound, 65 pence would come off your universal credit. Now they've changed the taper rate to 63%, so you've got an extra 2 pence out of every pound that you keep as your income without it reducing your universal credit entitlement.
I mean, that feels to me like a change at the margins. Am I being unfair? Is it actually, you know, being able to keep an extra 2 pence in every pound, is that going to make a meaningful difference, or is it not really helping people who do want to go into work, are able to go into work, and are able therefore to earn some more money?
Well, Turn to Us, we think that every penny counts, so we're pleased to hear that people will be better, that little bit better off when they're going into work. We would welcome any policy changes that would reduce that percentage that little bit more, so that it's a smoother transition from benefits to work.
Okay. Now, talking about the sort of transition from benefits to work, Andrew, I noticed that one of the other changes for parents who are on universal credit, including lone parents, which does tend to be mothers, is this work-focused interviews, and what seems to be changing is that that lone parents or parents will have to go for work-focused interviews when their youngest child is 1 year old, and then you'll basically be expected to be looking for work when your youngest child is three. Does that help? Because, you know, the mantra has often been that, you know, work is good for, you know, financially as well as obviously kind of mentally and for your sort of social well-being. Is this helpful for parents and mothers in particular?
It's a mixed bag. So the gradual reduction of the age at which the government expects lone parents who are on benefits to start looking for work does appear to have had a positive impact on women's employment rates. However, there are real questions around the way that job centres interact with with mothers of young children, and the way that mothers are supported to get into work. So our investigation a few years ago into the support the job centres provide for single parents found that actually they got a pretty raw deal, that they were more likely to be sanctioned for no reason and more likely to have those sanctions then overturned on appeal. And So we know that there's a risk that they won't really be treated as they should be by the job centres that they'll now be interacting at an earlier age with. And there's a further issue around the support that's actually provided to parents to enable them to get into work. So, you know, asking mothers to go back to work earlier is not in itself a bad thing, but more support needs to be provided.
And you mentioned the sanctions by job centres. So this is basically where your benefit is stopped for a period if you... And it can be things like if you basically don't attend your appointments. And is it, I mean, I've heard, I was actually talking to an MP about this a while ago, and he was saying he was finding a lot of single mothers were being sanctioned because maybe their childcare was cancelled at the last minute. They couldn't get someone to look after their child. They were either late because they then had to get themselves and their child out of the house rather than just themselves, or they couldn't go at all, maybe if their child wasn't well, things like that. I mean, that just sounds, you know, that just sounds callous, frankly, that you're penalising someone for things that are just completely beyond their control. Is that what we're talking about, or actually can the sanctions be for much, you know, for reasons that some people might say are positive, in inverted commas?
So the sanctions regime is intended to I think penalise the latter situation, but for the, you know, in far too many situations, it ends up hitting women who are late for appointments for, you know, very good reasons. As I said, that's why you see a lot of single mothers who appeal against those sanctions and then have them overturned. So, yeah, there is definitely a bit of the former.
Kelly, is that something you see as well? Do you? I don't know whether you sort of, as a charity, how involved you get with this, but in terms of the sanctions that Andrew was talking about, which can seem to unfairly penalise, you know, single mums who are trying to sort of sort out getting back into work and their children as well.
We do hear from a lot of people who are under sanction and are looking for help to either challenge the decision or get their benefits up and running again. It can be a real issue for people who are sanctioned. A lot of times sanctions can be delayed, so it may be that the offence took place some weeks ago and then the sanction comes through a bit later, and then they're suddenly without any money and having to go to food banks. We get calls from quite a few people in that situation. We're always just looking to make sure that they have access to advice, look for a local benefits advisor for them to go and see, and to look for any emergency assistance that might be available in their area and point them in that direction.
And Kelly, one of the other sort of big changes that has come in at the start of April were changes to bereavement benefits, which are going to affect widowed parents in particular. Now, there has been sort of a bit of a campaign about this over the last couple of weeks. I have to say, sort of, it seemed to be starting quite late in the day, although that may not be what's going on behind the scenes. But there's definitely been quite a lot of campaigning over the last couple of weeks, because these changes are going to really limit the length of time you can claim bereavement benefits for, won't they?
Yes. Previously, people could receive bereavement benefits until their youngest child had turned 18. Now it's only going to be 18 months after the death of the partner. So a lot of people are going to find that that's a struggle to have their income suddenly drop after 18 months when 18 months isn't, you can't put a time limit on grief. So it's, there has been a lot of campaigning about it because there's not really any support available after that 18 months. It's just, there's your money and now you can get on with it. You can go back to work. It's almost as if they expect you to get straight back into it. That's why there's been a lot of campaigning about it. There is more information available about the changes on our website. So if anyone thinks they may be affected, it's a really good idea to have a look, just to double check what they could be entitled to. We're always looking to make sure that everyone knows as much as they can about their rights. So have a look on turntous.org.uk if you're not sure.
And Andrew, I mean, obviously, you know, bereavement, you know, can affect anybody, but being sort of brutal about it, sometimes, you know, more women are affected because more men, you know, men tend to die a bit earlier than women. Now, obviously, some of these benefit changes affect widowed parents and would only affect you if you had a child aged up to 18 anyway. But, you know, there is a concern here, and that there has been sort of, I think, quite a lot of research done over the years into how these cuts fall and where they fall hardest. What's the Fall Society's sort of view on this?
Sure. So it does seem likely that the bereavement benefit changes will affect women more. As you say, men have higher mortality rates, particularly under the age of 60, which is so I believe that the bereavement benefits are only really available to people under the state pension age. I mean, these are part of an overall raft of benefit changes since 2010, which have impacted women more than men. 57% of the impact of tax and benefit changes has been on women, and 86% of the overall impact of spending cuts has been on women.
So we have got an election just over a month away. Are benefits an election issue? Because it seemed that a number of years ago that they were, but now sort of the narrative seems to be that benefit cuts are here to stay. What are your thoughts, Andrew?
I think that the extent to which benefits are the key issue for this election is, you know, that they are lower on the agenda, I think, than they have been at previous elections. They are still a major issue for a lot of people, particularly for a lot of women, as they hit them hardest. And so, you know, we're hopeful that people will take the government, the different parties' views on benefits into account when they're choosing how to vote.
And presumably you're going to be sort of talking about this between now and the election on June the 8th in particular.
Yes, we will. We'll be campaigning across a host of different issues ahead of the election. One of our key areas is around the gender pay gap and what we can do to narrow that. Obviously, benefits in a lot of ways are a sticking plaster on the flaws within our economy around housing, around work. So if you can get more women into work on better pay, then you can really start to tackle the benefits bill.
And Kelly, just before we end, I just want to talk about one other area of benefits, because we talk about families, we quite often think, you know, kind of families and children, but actually a lot of families, a lot of women end up looking after an elderly family member. It seems to kind of fall disproportionately on sort of women's shoulders. Carers benefits, attendance allowance, things like that, these are benefits that often people can miss out on. So just remind us again where they can get help on the website, and also just any advice or tips you'd give.
Well, always, if you're struggling, check your entitlement. We like to send people to our benefits calculator on our website, because you can just put in your details online and just get your results on the screen. We know that 16.6 billion per year of benefits goes unclaimed. So when people are struggling, we're thinking, well, there's 16.6 billion not being claimed, so make sure you're getting what you're entitled to. We also know that around 57% of low-income households are deterred from claiming because they think, oh, well, I'm not entitled. So it's always worth checking. There are always other benefits as well as means-tested ones. When I say means-tested, I mean if you've got a lower income, you tend to get more of them. But you may get other benefits like attendance allowance or carers allowance or personal independence payment if you've got a disability, which don't depend on your income. So if you're entitled to those, do have a go at claiming. We've got information on our website for those benefits. You can either just search for the name of the benefit on the website, or you can go to our Your Situation pages. So we've got a page for carers, or a page for ill, injured or disabled, or a page for older people. So you can just have a look to see what else there is and read through the information. We also have details for how to claim and what the process is. So it's we just want to get everyone on our website to get all the information they need to get what they're entitled to, so they can increase their chances of getting out of poverty and staying out of poverty.
Well, thank you very much indeed. That was Kelly Jones, who is from the charity Turn to Us. And she mentioned the website. It's turntous with a number 2.org.uk. And I was also joined in the studio by Andrew Baisley of the Fawcett Society. If you want to know more about the benefit changes, then there's an article on my website. There's also an article on the front page, which has been shared so far over 1,800 times on Facebook, which is my money manifesto for women, which includes a few things that I think any future government should do to make sure that women don't lose out financially. And that's on my website, savvywoman.co.uk.